This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
This is Bloomberg Markets from New York to our audience worldwide, a global simulcast right now across Bloomberg TV, radio, and our YouTube platforms. Romain Bostic here alongside Tim Stenovek and Kriti Guptik here on this New Year's Eve. Happy New Year, guys.
Hey, Happy New Year to you too.
Yeah, they're already celebrating somewhere, right? I think Pakistan right now just hit midnight. So congratulations to all our friends out there in Karachi.
Hey, if we were to go back to January, Romain,
yeah,
the S&P 500, the estimates from analysts, they were saying, okay, the most bullish case back in January, about 4,400 points.
Yeah.
Look where we are now.
Yeah.
Just shy of 4,800.
Yeah. 4,800 here on the S&P 500. You talk about the gains that we booked this year. I mean, look, three straight years of gains on the S&P 500, double-digit percentage gains. The NASDAQ, keep in mind, I think we're something like six straight years now here too. So, Kriti, this has been a remarkable bull run, or a certain leg of whatever this bull run has been, despite some of the weakness that we're seeing, at least on this final day of the year.
Yeah, remarkable is, I think, the key word there. And you just heard Tim talk about that $4,400 price target for the S&P 500 in 2021. Well, what's interesting is that's also the low end of the forecast for 2022 as well. Essentially, the message here is that the stock market can go anywhere. Just because we had those really monstrous gains in the last 3 years does not mean that they'll sustain. But hey, if you have tech on your side, why not have that pretty bullish case as well?
Yeah, and a big concern now, of course, is a lot of the catalysts that helped get us this 27% gain on the S&P 500 this year, those, some of those catalysts might not necessarily be around in 2022. Let's get some perspective from our first guest here, helping us kick off the show, Jay Hatfield. He's Infrastructure Capital Portfolio Manager and Chief Investment Officer. Jay, let's start off with 2022 and what potentially could actually be an impediment for this market.
Thanks, Romain. Happy New Year to everyone. Well, as usual, the really critical judgment to make is what is Federal Reserve policy going to be. We're quite bullish about Fed policy. If you look, the Fed has caused, there's been 19 tightenings of policy since World War II. 11 of those resulted in a recession, 8 of them in a soft landing. But we do think that the Fed got religion over the last couple of years. They've abandoned their single target of 2%, which is completely unsubstantiated, by the way. They just made that up. And now they're more flexible. Plus, we're going to have more Biden appointees. So we think that they'll focus on their dual mandate. They'll stick to the dot plot, just raise rates three times, and not start quantitative tightening, which is a disaster for the market. That's what happened in 2018. Is the Fed was shrinking the balance sheet. Right now, they're not slated to shrink the balance sheet. Just stop the excess liquidity.
Jay, what is, you know, we've been talking to a lot of analysts throughout the week about 2022. Many of them agree the biggest risk is a misstep by the Fed. What do you think the biggest risk is?
Well, I think that, I mean, obviously that is the biggest risk. But what goes along with that is really just disinflation accelerate beyond everybody's expectations. So a couple of months ago, our calculations were that inflation with run rate was double digits, because keep in mind the BLS does not properly mark rents to market, and energy inflation was raging at the time. So if inflation prints hot, then I don't know if it's a policy mistake, but the Fed may have to prioritize inflation reduction over employment. So that's really the key risk, is accelerating inflation, because I do think that you can't increase the money supply by 82% and have no inflation. That's really, in effect, what the transitory theory of inflation was. So the key risk is double-digit inflation, I'd say.
So Jay, what happens when the opposite of what you just said takes place? Let's say inflation, which is really where the Fed is throwing all of their firepower at right now, their focus, as you mentioned. Well, what if inflation has already peaked? What if we're already dealing with those supply chain issues? We're dealing with the Omicron variant. We're also dealing with commodity prices that have peaked and are perhaps coming back down. What's the trade there if the labor market turns out to be a bigger problem than inflation?
Well, I mean, that actually, I think that could be work out fairly well, because that would, you know, really imply a soft landing. So to the extent that the economy is slower than we expect, I wouldn't think that would be a disaster for stocks at all. And in fact, also interest rates would probably stay relatively stable. So that scenario, I think, would be positive. We're projecting 3-4% growth for a number of reasons. One of the biggest being that the U.S. has a 90% cost advantage over the rest of the world in electricity and natural gas. So we don't see that scenario, but I don't think that would be a disaster, because it would give the Fed more headroom to not raise rates and do quantitative tightening.
Yeah, I mean, so much focus on the Fed this year and its effect that it's going to have on equities and, I guess, to a certain extent on the bond market here. But what about some of the other risk assets? I mean, we talk about all of the sort of a push down out onto the risk spectrum because of that implicit Fed support here, whether it's cryptocurrencies, whether it's some of the real estate and private equity deals out there. How does some of those trades are affected by potential tightening here by the Fed?
Well, I think there's a great implicit point there, Romain, which is that people talk about interest rates being the key dynamic that drives the market. But, you know, interest rates are so low, the key dynamic really is the equity risk premium. So that's the premium plus treasuries is what the required rate of return is. So when the Fed's reducing liquidity, that rises. So that disadvantages riskier stocks like a Tesla that has a 2 beta, and it advantages more conservative stocks like utilities that have a beta or sensitivity to the market about 0.5. So we think that the Dow is going to outperform next year, the S&P significantly, sort of the reverse of this year, because those value stocks will outperform the high momentum stocks when the equity risk premium is rising slightly.
Okay. Hey, Jay, we were talking about year to date, what the major indices have done. The Dow up close to 20%, the S&P 500 handily outperforming over 27%. What's your estimate for how the S&P 500 is going to end 2022?
Well, we're optimistic the Dow will be up 10%. I would say the S&P could be closer to flattish or up 5%, because I do think that a large percentage of the S&P, I mean, obviously the easiest one to see, of course, is Tesla, which is 2%. But are trading at huge multiples, 125 times in their case. So those stocks are likely to continue to underperform or even go down as that equity risk premium rises and it hits those high value stocks. And we're also bearish about cryptocurrencies for the same reason. They're about 25% correlated with inflation expectations. So to the extent that expectations drop, then that could hurt cryptocurrencies as well.
Jay Hatfield of Infrastructure Capital, thanks so much for joining us on the simulcast. We really appreciate it. Hey, bearish on crypto. We were speaking earlier to some folks on Quick Take Stock today, one from U.S. Bank and one from Citi as well. Asked the same question about crypto. No place for crypto in their portfolios, at least in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, we've heard from a lot of folks who say that kind of the correlations that we've seen between the crypto sphere and, I guess, the real world here, that's starting to catch up with a lot of those crypto investors. I'm not sure I really buy that, because, I mean, when you start to look at some of why people are sort of invested in this and the thesis behind it, it seems like at least there's some sort of degree of support, at least on the downside here, 46,000 right now, right?
You know, Romain, what was the other thing he said? He said that value is the trade that he really bets on going into 2022. That's interesting. That's a contrarian take, because that's a traditional post-recessionary play. That was the 2021 trade, not necessarily the Wall Street consensus for 2022.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we talked about this earlier this week, the divergence that we've actually seen between some of those value and growth stocks in the second half of the year. Remember, the Russell 2000 was a massive outperformer in the first, 2.5-3 months of the year. It was something like a 15 percentage point difference between the Russell and the S&P. Still a 15 percentage point difference between the Russell and the S&P, but it's flipped on its head right now.
Welcome back to our simulcast of the close on Bloomberg Television, Bloomberg Radio, and on YouTube. I'm Tim Stenovec, joined by Kriti Gupta and Romain Bostic. We are just over an hour away from the equity markets close on this final trading day of the year. Let's bring in Bloomberg Markets' Abigail Doolittle with an update. Hey, Abigail.
Hey, Tim. Well, you know, on this day, we're looking at stocks fluctuating between small gains and losses. The S&P 500, the last moment that I looked, slight gain. So perhaps we'll see the 71st record close of the year. But again, small moves on the day. On the year, though, it's a different story of massive gains for the S&P 500. The NASDAQ 100 both up more than 27%. The Dow up about 18%. The Russell 2000 underperforming a little bit, up just 14%, if you can say up just, because it, of course, is a double-digit game. Confirming the risk on tone, bonds down in a huge way with that 10-year yield backing up nearly 60 basis points.
Yeah, Abigail, a quiet day in the stock market, a quiet day in the bond market, but it seems like there's some action in the commodities market. I'm looking at oil down 2% at the commodities close. Why see such a divergence there?
Probably the fact that oil into today, Kriti, had been up, I believe, 7 days in a row, a big winning streak, the best, longest winning streak since February. So just cooling off a little bit. Plus, oil on the year, a huge rally, up, I believe, nearly 60%. WTI crude on the year up 56%, its best year since 2009. So locking in some profits. Also, it could reflect just some concerns around the Omicron. Will it dent the global growth picture in 2022, one of many questions for us to answer in the new year.
All right, Abigail Doolittle giving us a quick update here on where we stand as we count down, of course, to the close of trading on this day and, of course, of 2021. A big story in 2021, of course, were all the cyber attacks that we talked about, ransomware attacks and other types of cybersecurity threats out there. A lot of companies really trying to beef up their IT systems and governments, for that matter, too, to protect themselves. Our next guest knows a lot about this, Tony Anscombe. He's ESET Chief Cyber Threat Officer, joining us right now. Tony, I guess the big question everyone wants to know is, how, if at all, can you stop this? This seems like it's just become its own animal, whether it's organized gangs, whether it's governments, or whether it's just sort of lone wolf types who just want to, you know, mess around and, you know, basically just screw something up. How do you stop this? How do you guard against it?
Well, unfortunately, this is a business. And as you just said, it comes from a series of different places. But cyber criminals are making huge amounts of money, unfortunately, from holding companies to ransom, and companies are handing over that cash. Realistically, I mean, you're now seeing legislation come through of responsibility to disclose. I expect that in 2022, maybe to become not just disclosed after the incident, but disclosed during the incident. But to me, you have to start regulating in some way or locking down cryptocurrency in some manner, and actually cut the money off.
How would you do that? I mean, the idea behind that, of course, and we know that you can actually track cryptocurrency. We saw the government do that in the case of the Colonial Pipeline ransom that was paid. How do you do that, though? What do authorities have the power to actually do to help prevent this?
Well, isn't this an investment just like anything else? It's an investment tool. So therefore, if I walk into any bank in the US and try and open an account, I have to identify and be my identification has to be verified. If we were verifying globally, I mean, this is a global issue, not a specific country issue. If globally to hold cryptocurrency, you had to validate identity, then you cut the money supply off.
Tony, how much of this latest push to really kind of ramp up some of that cybersecurity comes from geopolitical tensions with, say, China, with, say, Russia, or even Iran, to that matter?
Well, certainly the push to have better cybersecurity, I think, has become political because when you mentioned Colonial Pipeline earlier on, I mean, that any cybercrime that creates a line outside of a gas station is going to have political effect because no politician can have their citizens affected by this type of issue. But we're seeing, you know, Interpol, for example, back in, I think it was November, made a series of arrests, but that covered 17 countries. There was seven arrests for people that are responsible for $200 million in ransomware payments. So you can see this is not a particular country. This is a global issue. And I think until the world comes together and actually has a summit on stopping cybercrime,
yeah,
and puts all the right people in the room, then we're unlikely to see a lot of movement or a lot of decrease.
But you talk about us coming together to a certain extent. It feels like we're all sort of fracturing apart here. Seems like certain countries don't trust other countries. You know, we've obviously had a lot of concerns in the United States about buying certain types of equipment and software from China and other countries as well here. I mean, where do we sort of find that middle ground?
Well, that's a tough one. And just before the holiday period, I mean, we saw an additional issue with Log4j, so which is a small piece of code that had a vulnerability in it that's used as it's open source, it's free code. A lot of vendors use that in hardware and software and services, and companies use it. So we see issues in supply of that type hitting. And unfortunately, they're huge. When they do hit, companies have to scan and find out where they use this code and then try and mitigate against issues. So it's a global issue that requires a global response. And countries coming together in groups is great, but until you bring every country that has a significant part of this into one room, I think you're not grasping the whole issue.
Hey, Tony, oftentimes when we read about these cyber attacks, we read that cyber criminals were able to penetrate a system based on an employee maybe clicking a malicious link or downloading a malicious file. So I always like to ask people in your position about what individuals should do, how we should protect ourselves. Give us some best practices.
Well, firstly, don't trust anything that lands in your inbox. If it has a link, if it's to an external site, for example, a retailer or something else, or it's asking for verification of credentials, it's likely not to be real. So just don't trust links that land in your inbox. Go to the website, log on manually. And the problem is people trust those links. They go in, they give away their credentials, and hey, the cyber criminal has access. But we've also seen other issues throughout 2021 where vulnerabilities in software have allowed cyber criminals to get access in other ways. But you are right, employees and unfortunately human behavior, we like to click on things, yeah, and we need to be the first line of defense.
All right, so be careful when you click. Tony Anscombe, the ESET Chief Cyber Threat Officer. Tony, Happy New Year. Thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg. Appreciate it.
Well, Tim, we do have some breaking news here. I'm really sorry to report that Betty White, one of the most endearing and enduring faces on television, she has passed away at the age of 99 at her home in Los Angeles. She was one of the just key faces when it comes to Golden Girls, when it comes to television. We are very sorry to lose her. I'm still in shock, and I imagine you all are as well, just shy of her 100th birthday, which would have been on January 17th.
A pioneer, too. I mean, everyone, of course, knows her from Golden Girls, but what she did back in the 60s with her talk show and with her sitcom here, being one of the first women, I believe, to even have full production control, full creative control over her own show at a time when that was just unheard of.
Yeah, and I think what's also particularly remarkable about her career is just how long it went. And well into her 90s, she was doing commercials. And, you know, she was on Twitter, too.
Yeah, and like one of the few people out there that I think is beloved by everyone, right? Yeah. We live in such a divisive world. And at least there's somebody I think we can all agree that we certainly love. We say goodbye to Miss Betty White. This is Bloomberg Markets, a special edition here simulcast across Bloomberg TV and radio and YouTube as well. 2 p.m. here in New York, 8 p.m. in London, midnight out there in Dubai. Happy New Year to everyone out there, if you celebrate.
Who does? Well, yeah. Are you going to? What are you
doing? I know. Tim, you're kind of a Grinch, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, so my sister actually is flying in. So we're doing something. But yeah, I've been a real COVID Grinch, to be honest.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are, guys, trying to hunker down today. A few people, I guess, are going to brave the outside and go out to their bars or out to Times Square. We'll see. Yeah. As far as the markets here, I don't think anyone's really trading right now. The bond markets already closed down here. The equity markets, they're still open for reasons that I still haven't had explained to me. I'm told Tim tells me that there's a whole story about why we're here today. But nevertheless, there is an hour left in trading here. Apple not going to hit that $3 trillion here in 2021 unless there's some major turnaround here in the final hour of trading. Carnival Corp and most of the cruise lines lower here as well on a daily basis. Ford, one of the few bright spots out there, up about 2% right now. Let's jump over to Abigail Doolittle, who's taking a closer look at what's going on around the markets. Abigail.
Well, Romain, with those small moves on the day, with the major indexes fluctuating between small gains and losses, let's go right to where the real bright spot is. And that, of course, is the whole year of 2021. 2021, a real risk asset rally with the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ 100 both up more than 27%. The stocks with that chip index up more than 40%. Tech up about 33%. Small cap a laggard, but still up about 14%. All of this, of course, confirmed by the fact that Haven bonds are down on the year. The 10-year yield backing up about 60 basis points. Interestingly, though, the 2-year yield backed up just a little bit more. So the yield curve has actually flattened a little bit, and in the case of the 530s, even more so. But as for the risk rally, oil up 56% this year, the best since 2009. It's really pretty incredible, the risk picture for this year.
Yeah, Abigail, let's just talk about that. The recovery trade in 2021 was supposed to be the trade that really took off. You were supposed to see it in small caps, in travel stocks, and commodities, to your point. Can we actually expect to see that in 2022, or is that officially in the rearview mirror?
I think we're going to have to see what happens with this Omicron and also with the economy, the influence on the economy. It seems that most strategists believe it won't be the biggest deal. Relative to this year, sector-wise, it was really a nice blend. You know, you have energy, which, of course, is in a cyclical and growth area, up the most, up 47%. Interestingly, another official growth sector, real estate up strongly, tech, financials. On bottom, very interesting this year, the defensive sector, such as utilities and staples. Often when that happens, you can see those reverse into next year. We don't know if that's the case, but I believe in 2020, energy was the worst sector, this year the best. So if utilities and staples end up being on top next year, it could turn out to be a defensive year. Way too early to say that for sure, though.
All right, Abigail Doolittle giving us that update, 3 p.m. in New York. Here, Ed Cofrancesco, CEO of International Assets Advisory, joining us right now to talk a little bit more about what's going on in the market today, and more importantly, where he sees the market going in 2022. Abigail was just showing us some data showing that basically every sector in the S&P 500 up 10% on the year or more. Do you see those types of gains replicating themselves in 2022?
Well, Romain, first, good afternoon and happy new year to you and your colleagues.
Thank you.
I really wish we could say that, but we at International Assets believe that 2021 is now in our rearview mirror. A year, year and a half ago at IAA, we were looking for markets to respond just like they have. I remember talking to people a year, year and a half ago and predicting 35,000 Dow and 15,000 NASDAQ and 5,000 S&P, and they all thought I was smoking crack. Turns out we were right. But we also anticipated inflation. We started calling inflation in February. And now we get so many mixed signals from the market. We believe that when you look at the job recovery, you know, how much job creation we have in the United States, the best way to describe it's feeble. But at the same time, while it's feeble, we're having near record lows in unemployment. We still have a huge supply chain problem. We don't see that being solved anytime in the near future. And yet we have all-time highs and near-time all-time highs in all the markets. So what we see for 2022 is that in the short term, the very short term, we continue to see the market still being strong. But we expect that ultimately the negatives are going to outweigh the positives, and that this is going to have to be a coming year, a very defensive year.
A defensive year, a risk-off year, would you say?
I think there's a real potential, Tim, that 6 months from now, 9 months from now, we're looking at a major correction. And we don't view corrections of, you know, 5 or 10% or 15% here at IA. We're talking that we can see a 20 to 35% correction. Wow. We're really expecting that's a possibility.
That's a very contrarian call for a very bullish Wall Street, I should say, probably about the retail crowd as well. I'm curious, though, how you play tech into all of this, because at the end of the day, tech leads the S&P 500 to record highs, but it also leads those corrections. Is that essentially a call on tech?
So that's a very good question. We think tech is going to continue to be strong for a couple of more months, a few more months, but that the chickens are going to come home to roost. And when that happens, you know, go back to the chart that we just had up there a little while ago where you showed tech and realty and so forth, and you guys talked about it inverting next year. That's exactly what we think we're going to see. The last few guests that you've had have been talking about all the things we're concerned about. Talked about that. I heard the conversation about cybersecurity. That's something we're extremely concerned about here at IAA. So all these conversations, that's the chart right there. I think we're going to see a real inversion of that chart by the end of next year.
Well, a part of that, I guess, what's going to determine that, of course, obviously, overall, the pace of the economy, not only here in the U.S. and abroad, but more importantly, the policy response that we get, whether it's monetary policy with the Fed or fiscal policy, whatever levers could be pulled in Congress or in the White House here. Do you see any sort of potential for policymakers to maybe, I guess, guide us to that proverbial soft landing?
I mean, there's always that potential. But quite honestly, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, IA doesn't put a lot of faith in stock in politicians. We think that the least they do, the better off we all are. And we always used to subscribe to that old, the congressional effect theory. For those of you who are not familiar about it, you should go read about it. There's a couple of discussion on it. So while we'd like to be hopeful that they could, we're not anticipating that they will. And one of the things that we're really interested in is, you know, I've been in this industry now for 40 plus years. And there was always this old adage about how the market is really just a reflection on the emotional attitude of investors and the people on the street. Well, I think there's been a real decoupling of that in the last year. I've never seen so much pessimism amongst the average people. And I'm with them. The average citizen in this country and around the world, we're scared. We're frightened of the future. Are we going to have a worse version of COVID? What's going to happen to the economy? What's happening with the inflation? We have all these questions. I just saw a poll just about an hour ago, the latest poll showing that, you know, well over 50% of the country is pessimistic about what's going on with the economy and their health and so forth. And yet the markets keep going to new highs. I don't think this decoupling can continue.
Hey, and Adam, so, yeah, I want to go back to that, what you said about a 20 to 35% correction. I think because Creedy's spot on by pointing out that that's a really contrarian view, especially with people we've talked to this week as we look ahead to 2022. What is that single event, perhaps, that brings on that correction? Because there is something always that does bring on a correction, right?
And there's so many events that could happen. I can't even begin to tell you. Inflation can continue to be much worse than anybody anticipated. We could have a geopolitical event. We could have a fourth wave. I'm going to call Omicron the third wave of COVID. We could have a fourth wave of COVID. People, we talk about whether there's people looking at a transaction or people following something. When something continues to go on, we start to get fatigued. People are really, really fatigued on COVID now. People just want to get back to a normal way of life. If, in 3 months or 6 months, as we're going through this third wave, we have a fourth wave of COVID. I don't know what that event is going to be. I just see so many potentials, and we here in doing our analysis at International Assets see so many potentials and the general sentiment of the investing public being so negative that we think something's got to give, and I can't tell you exactly what that's going to be.
All right. A big thank you to Ed Cofrancesco, CEO of International Assets Advisories, joining us. Ed, happy new year. A 20 to 35% correction. I still can't get beyond that, Creedy and Romain, considering it's so different than what we've heard from everyone else this week.
But not that uncommon, considering that we've had a really banner year with no corrections, not even a technical correction of 10%. So it may not be that wild of a call.
And there's a lot of concern, too. I mean, when you talk about monetary policy, how do you rein in inflation without tamping down economic growth? There are some people that said that effectively you have to almost create a recession. So if people do believe in that, I can certainly see why a 20% drawdown could be a little bit more realistic. This is Bloomberg Markets, a special edition here, simulcast on Bloomberg Radio and TV, as well as YouTube. Romain Bostic here, Tim Stenovic, Creedy Gupta, counting you down to the closing bells on this Friday afternoon, final trading day of the year. We're just about 11 minutes or so away from the end of the trading day. And you talk about the performance that we've seen here going back all the way from the start of the year to the end. The Philadelphia Semiconductor Index having a wonderful year, up about 42% here on a year-to-date basis. Energy, though, that's your outperformer. Among the 11 S&P sectors, it's actually the energy sector that's actually outperformed here, up about 48% year-to-date. And when you look at the 24 S&P subsectors, the S&P groups here, the worst performer, you're going to find that among the telecom companies, AT&T, Verizon, and the like, are all lower here on a year-to-date basis. That index down 12%. And guys, I want to highlight the bank stocks here because everyone keeps talking about the underperformance of bank stocks. The KBW Bank Index is up about 35% on the year. The best year that that index has seen going back to 1997, even the KRX, which is a regional bank index, having its best year since 2016. So for all the hand-wringing about how some of the bank stocks haven't really kept up, you're sitting on some pretty healthy gains. JP Morgan up 25% on a year-to-date basis. Bank of America returning 47%, if you can believe that, guys.
Yeah, it's really crucial when you're talking about the banks in particular, because the relationship to yields is what's been so crucial. If you start to see yields continue to drop in 2022, continue to see those treasury yields really suppressed, does that show up in those bank stocks?
But let's not forget what a banner year it was for M&A and just the huge gains that the banks were able to get just in terms of fees from SPACs, from IPOs, and the M&A that we talked about yesterday. So the question is, does it continue into 2022?
That's the big question here. And let's bring in our next guest here, Matt Maley. He is Chief Market Strategist for Miller Tabak, joining us right now. And Matt, you know, let's talk about kind of some of the catalysts for the market. I mean, we came out of 2020, and that was basically all about fiscal policy. That kind of fed into at least the first portion of 2021. But now as we get towards the end of the year here and into 2022, the focus seems to be squarely on monetary policy and whether that's going to be a tailwind or a headwind to further gains in this market.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, one of the things we have to realize is that this, you know, this headwind I think is going to be is, you know, we're going from a situation with the Fed in the past, whenever they've gone, or not whenever, but usually when they go from to a tightening policy, it's usually from a neutral policy. In this situation, we have when they're going from an ultra accommodative policy to a tightening policy. And again, it's not like they're slamming the brakes in a major way, but I think we'd all agree, I mean, you can just see by the level of the stock market, the level of valuations in the stock market, it is expensive. I mean, we all know that in the summer of 2020, that all this stimulus pushed the stock market well ahead of the fundamentals, but we felt the fundamentals would play catch up as the COVID problem eased off. We did get past the emergency. The problem is we kept the emergency stimulus on, and so we were never able to fully catch up. So now the stimulus is going to have a pullback a little bit. I think it does have to, you know, at best case scenarios, we meet somewhere in the middle, but usually it's at the lower half of that middle, I'm afraid, if history is any guide.
But Matt, what other option does the Fed have going into 2022 as inflation hits 40-year highs and we continue to see prices rise higher?
Yeah, I agree. One of the biggest fallacies I think out there is that people saying, you know, well, the Fed might make a policy mistake. And when they say that, what they're saying is that they call a mistake, a policy mistake, as being causing the markets to go down. Well, that's not what the Fed's. I mean, we've kind of gotten used to them, you know, having the Fed put, the Powell put, the Bernanke used to be the Bernanke put, et cetera. But they've lowered that safety net. And they're doing the right thing. You're absolutely right. They're doing the right thing. The problem is sometimes the Fed, I mean, Volcker certainly did it. Sometimes the Fed has to do some things that are a little bit painful over the near term so that things will work out over the long term. I mean, our parents did that when we were kids all the time. And this is something we have to do now. And again, you know, corrections, even deep ones, are painful, but they're also normal. They're healthy. They're part of capitalism. So people should embrace them, not fear them.
Matt, you said the C word, correction. My ears perked up immediately. I really want to ask you about that, perhaps a correction in 2022. We just had a guest who was calling for a 20 to 35% correction in the S&P 500 next year. My question to you is, if we do see a correction, 10%, 20%, however much, do you start to see dip buyers immediately hop in and recover those gains within days? That has at least been the pattern that you've seen in 2021, with at least the shallow pullbacks that we've had in the S&P 500.
Yeah, but I think it goes back to what we were just talking about with the Fed. I mean, one of the reasons they were successful in doing that is there was so much liquidity sloshing around in the system. Well, that's going to go from $120 billion a month from the Federal Reserve to zero in just a couple of months. So I think those buy on the dips are going to continue to try it. And this time they're going to get burned. I mean, the history has shown buy the dip isn't a brand new thing that's worked, you know, this year. It worked very well in many other years. And then finally, when we do see the correction, those guys get burned. And that's what happens is that you know, the situation where they buy, and then finally say, oh, this isn't working, and they dump, and you get a big washout move. So, and then the thing you're asking about a deep correction like that, or a bear market, whatever you want to call it, it is possible, because, you know, one of the things that all this stimulus has done is helped investors add risk, and especially add leverage. With, you know, margin debt all-time high, it's starting to roll over. As people de-risk, and especially as they de-leverage, we could see an outsized decline. But again, if you have a little cash on the sidelines, you'll keep your head when the market's getting clobbered. You'll be able to buy on the dip instead of being forced to sell when everybody else is, the leverage players are selling at the absolute wrong time, you know, down near the lows.
Matt Maley, Chief Market Strategist over at Miller Tabak.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.